The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I'm very happy to be here again. I'm just remembering that my first book actually came partly out of a series of workshops I did with this group back in 98, I think, so you helped me. Can everybody hear in the back all right? Good. I'm back with my spiritual practice theme. The topic of my talk today is aging as a spiritual practice. This is my new focus. I have a blog of that name. agingasaspiritualpractice.com, which I've been running for several months. And I'm doing other online things. I came to realize that a couple of things. One is the Dharma gate opens in a human life, I think, at certain times particularly. I think it opens sometimes in some historical situations when we're young. In the middle of what has come to be called the identity crisis. Who am I? 19, 20, 21. In other words, the 60s for many of us. That happens to be a core Buddhist question. Who am I? What am I doing here? So that's a Dharma question. And somehow the spark got lit for a whole generation around that. I don't know how often that moment comes. There has to be special circumstances for that. But I think it always comes when we're older. Because the most fundamental teaching of the Buddha and the basis of all Buddhist practice is that everything changes. Nothing lasts. I came up with a slogan for my blog, because the blog is open to the whole universe and lots of people don't know about Buddhism. So I said, Buddhism in one sentence, everything is connected, nothing lasts, and you are not alone. the Buddha could just as well have said in this context, everything changes, everything ages. And in particular, we do. Actually, we're aging all the time, but it takes a while to notice it. and then we do. And then we have various reactions to it. So I've adopted Woody Allen's joke about dying for aging. You know, he says, I really don't mind the thought of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens to me. So we slot in the word aging and we have the same sentiment, you know. So I think that there are, I've come to realize from my blog commenters and other things, that there are three segments to this aging process, three cohorts, you might say. The first one is when our parents start to age and become ill or need critical care or become demented or something. And we might be young and healthy, we might be in our 30s, but if our parents are going through this and we suddenly have to drop everything and be involved in sometimes very difficult decisions, very difficult situations, and also to realize that in some of those cases, we suddenly, even though we're not ready, have to be the parents to our parents if they're no longer healthy. That really hits us. I can think of two stories. One from my blog, a man who was 37 posted and said, I just got back from the doctor's office and the doctor said gently that mom is terminal, she's going to die. And it suddenly hit me for the first time like a ton of bricks. I'm going to die. I never really got that somehow. I thought maybe there would be an exception made for me. This is This is, of course, our natural human tendency. Denial is a wonderful survival mechanism. But so that's the first stage. I think the second stage is where 55 million baby boomers are now, maybe many of you, which is I'm really not so young anymore, and I'm not getting any younger. And it particularly comes home when our friends start to die. You know, at first it's kind of a random thing here and there, but then it starts to be a steady drumbeat, one a year, two a year, three a year. And it really, so this is teaching, actually. I think this is free Dharma teaching from the universe. And so I'd like to just review some of the basic teaching that the Buddha taught around these points. The Buddha was a kind of, you know, Gautama was kind of a revolutionary in many respects. And he taught that there were three observations that he felt could be pretty solidly understood about our world. One is, as I said, everything changes. Nothing stays the same for long. This was quite a radical thing, and we're still, I think, trying to understand what that really means. Scholars call this teaching impermanence. But over the years, I've felt that impermanence is a little scholarly, a little dry. You know, it's like an academic term. What it really means emotionally for us is loss. Things that we care about are not going to last. And in particular, this precious human body and the precious human bodies of all that we, the people that we love, is not going to last. That's the first teaching. The second teaching is, these are called the three marks of conditioned existence. Some of you may know this teaching. The second mark is dukkha. Dukkha is often translated as suffering. But again, scholars got in early and said it meant suffering. I think dukkha is a far more nuanced word. But again, it really means loss. And it doesn't, you know, in the early days and even now, a lot of people think of this teaching about when they hear what they hear off on the web or wherever on their text, on their cell phone, is the Buddha said everything is suffering, which he didn't say. And they say, I'm not into that. I'm not into that suffering thing. My son says that a lot of his friends, when he tells them his father's a Buddhist priest, they say, I'm not into that suffering thing. Well, I think that's a bad translation. I think dukkha includes the full range of you know, human experience, joy, rapture, excitement, tragedy, loss, terror. Everything. But you draw a circle around all of that experience and you say, in the end, fundamentally, loss. It doesn't matter what it is. Loss is colors the whole thing. It has the color of loss, even though there may be so many different things in that circle. It has the color of loss. Why? Because nothing lasts. The last teaching, of course, is anatman, no permanent, fixed, abiding self, which in this context of aging means we're all going to die. And everything we care about is going to die. So this is, I think in the context of growing older, I want to fashion these three teachings a little bit. Impermanence means, you know, we're 50, we're 55, we're 60. A lot of things have happened. This is the thing that the second Dharma gate, that when we're older, I think is so different than the first one when we're so young, because by the time we've lived a life, a lot of water has gone under the bridge. A lot of things have happened. A lot of things. And we've had to face them. There's been no choice. That's what living means. And that's teaching. That can be teaching if your eyes are open. As one poet wrote, I can't remember, maybe it was John Ashbery, the things that happened to happen. The things that happened to happen are fixed now. They've happened. The dreams that we had when we were young perhaps didn't come to pass, or they did come to pass, but they suddenly popped like a soap bubble unexpectedly. Our 401ks suddenly went down. You know, things happen, and we have to deal with them. This is the word that comes to mind, and that a lot of my blog people have used, is regret. We have a lot of regret by the time we're older. Things that we wish had happened and didn't. I often use the pig story from Seinfeld very briefly. I don't know if any of you are Seinfeld fans, but anyway, those that are, you remember Elaine. Elaine has always had schemes. So she wanted to get a cartoon in the New Yorker. That was really important to her. And she came up with this cartoon, and she was showing it to her friends. And the cartoon showed a little pig at the Macy's complaint counter looking up and saying plaintively, one imagines, "I wish I was taller." That's her cartoon. "I wish I was taller." You know, and I thought that's so poignant. You know, that's the human condition. You know, we're all like that. You know, whatever that means for you, taller, richer, more beautiful, more talented children, different kind of job, different career, things went differently. Regret. The pig is voicing the regret that we all have. I wish, you know. There's another, more profoundly and substantively, there's a beautiful etching of Blake's, William Blake's, some of you may know, called "I Want." And it shows him with a kind of a pool cue touching the moon. You know, the moon is up in the sky, and he's able to touch it with his stick. You know, I want that. You know, so this is regret. Dukkha means loss. It's wonderful to have the young body and the young energy that many of us had back in a long time ago to practice Dharma. You know, sit up all night, go to monasteries, travel to Asia, get sick, recover, feel immortal, have great dreams. But you know, a lot of that's rather unrealistic. And now many of us have children who have or are or will be going through that same process. And we look back and we realize, you know, the phrase "young and foolish" does come to mind. But when we're older, we don't have that same kind of young body. We don't have those same kind of hopes and dreams and aspirations. But we have experience. This is such a treasure. And this can all be now folded into the Dharma path. Aging as a spiritual practice, this is my way of saying this, is that the aging process itself brings forward so much teaching that's always been there, that Gautama didn't invent, he just noticed. You know, Gautama was simply a very talented, wise human being with the same equipment as each of us. He was not a god. So each of us, if we're alert, can look around and see what he saw. And, you know, there's a lot of teaching and meditation in Dharma about dying, about death. A monk is supposed to, or a nun is supposed to wake up every day and remember or recollect that this body is impermanent and death could come at any time. How morbid, we think. But on the other hand, each of these teachings has a liberative, I mean, Buddhism is all about liberation. It's not about feeling down. I think that there's really two halves to it. The first part is open your eyes, see what's out there. Stop fooling yourself. This is the first step. The second part is, how do we live? Look at what's out there and how do we live? How do we live in the light of these truths? These truths are not malleable. These truths are how it is. What's the going forward, uplifting, inspiring side of these teachings? What's the inspiring side of regret? You know, a lot of people get depressed when they get to midlife. It used to be called midlife crisis. There are a lot of people in their 50s chewing Prozac because they just don't feel too good about their life. I'm not going to put down a Prozac or any other medicine, but you know, the flip side of regret is going forward, there's always fresh chances. You know, nothing is fixed. It's fixed in both directions. Nothing lasts, but also new things can happen. That's the two sides of the same truth. One of my teachers used to say, his teacher used to say, every breath, new chances. Every breath, new chances. This is kind of a deep meditation instruction, you know, and I'll get to this in a minute when I talk about vertical time. regret is not the problem. Regret is human. And of course we feel sadness. If someone, a very good friend of ours, has died, we will feel regret of that loss for the rest of our life. That's not the problem. The problem is that we replicate that regret as though it's permanent, as though it's something that can't be overcome. That's what depression is. Depression is, as one psychiatrist said to me, the dwelling in sadness. It's not the sadness. Sadness is not actually depression. Sadness is, again, just a normal reaction. If we didn't feel sadness, how dull our life would be. It meant we didn't care about things. It meant things didn't matter to us. But the fact that they do, that's what makes us sad. And the more it matters, the more sad we are, you know. So grieving is not depression. Depression is to dwell and forget that every breath, new chances. So regret can launch us into a whole new appreciation for the life we have. In other words, gratitude. Gratitude is the teaching, the positive teaching and practice that emerges out of regret, the first mark. Loss, irrevocable loss. You know, aging, everybody has losses all the time. Kids have losses, you know, their dog dies or they don't get into the right school. And you, anybody who's our parents knows these things are so so wrenching for children, you know. But we also know, or the first girlfriend or boyfriend breaks up, you know. Tears, slamming doors, you know, they don't come out for days. you know, the headphones. But, you know, we know as older adults that this too will pass. But as we approach middle age and older, it's not just loss, it's irrevocable loss. That's what is different for us, irrevocable. There's no going back. That's deep and that's hard. And again, how do we turn that toward the path? The basic message of Dharma is that everything is raw material for the path, no matter what it is. Everything is, you know, all the raw material of life. You gather it up, you pick it up in a big sack, and you throw it into the Dharma machine, and it goes, you know, and outside the other end comes some illumination. And, you know, loss, can turn into a kind of freedom. We all have scars. We all have wounds. But there's a kind of freedom in that. You know, one of Jon Kabat-Zinn's books is called Full Catastrophe Living. You know this book. Well, he got that from Zorba the Greek. At one point the scholar asks Zorba about, something. Are you married? But also something about the war, and he strips off his shirt and he shows all of his scars. He's got scars here, scars there, bullet wounds here, knife wounds there, you know. And then he says all the wives he's had, and he said it, everything, the full catastrophe. You know, and this is what I'm talking about. You know, the folk. He was a joyous man, and that's the great gift of that book and that character. You know, as he was dying, this great moving scene, which is great in the movie too, where he gets out of bed, he's can barely do it, and he crawls to the window and he just looks out. You know, one last time to see the beautiful world that you know. He's an archetype of a person who turns all of his losses into living passionately for what he's got, you know. And so this leads to the last mark, no abiding self. In other words, we are going to die, but we're always dying, actually. Yesterday has died. Today is a new life. This is one of the many meanings of rebirth in Buddhism. So I'm going to come back in a month or so, October 24th, to do a one-day workshop or retreat here on this topic, aging as a spiritual practice. So perhaps some of you would like to join me and my two senior students. We'll do some practices, we'll do some discussion, we'll do some small group work. We'll learn from each other, because everybody has innate natural teaching about these things, how each of us are turning these issues to the path. But one practice, and I have some flyers. I brought 30, but I realize that's fairly inadequate for this crowd. So I don't know, maybe Linda, you want to take one and reproduce it or something for later. I'll leave it out here on the platform. Also, I think it's been in the newsletter, and there are other ways that you folks advertise things, so I don't want to spend my time hawking my wares too much, but anyway, this will be the one that can stay up here, and then I'll have the folder. But I did want to mention one of the things I'm trying to do is take all the basic practices that we do in Dharma, you know, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the body, metta practice, gratitude, and apply those specifically to the issues of aging. And so there's one in particular that I'd like to discuss. I've come up with a teaching about breath that I think relates directly to our sense of aging, and that is, I call it vertical time. So let me just take a minute to describe what I mean. This is going to turn out to be the same old breathing practice you've always done, but it's going to have a new lift to it, hopefully. Part of, I think, why people become depressed as they get older and dwell on their losses and their lost opportunities and the dwindling window of life that seems to be growing ever shorter, along with our savings, maybe. And new worries crop up. We have lots of things to worry about, if not for ourselves, for our children, for our parents, for our whole network of a lifetime of acquaintances and people we care about. There always, as you get older, seems to be somebody who's in crisis. So all of that, mental activity orients itself on a kind of timeline I call horizontal time. In other words, past, present, and future. Which I think is one of the things that Gautama, the Buddha, was trying to make us become aware of, is that this is a major source of unnecessary human suffering, is to organize our mental life horizontally in time. This is a kind of organization of the ego, actually. It's an organization of the self, and the self maintains itself and maintains its illusion of permanence by tending this horizontal garden of memories and of the past and worries about the future and agitation about the present. It's a kind of map that we all have, and it's a useful enough map. You know, if somebody says, do you remember in 1973 I did this or I did that, you'd like to be able to say, yes, you do. And that's one of the things that makes us feel, okay, still got some game. Still got some game. If you say, then you start to worry, you know. But, you know, we need that horizontal map for some things, you know, practical. But as a map of reality, it's not the whole picture. There is another kind of time called vertical. I call vertical time. And this is the time, pretty much, I think, only accessible through meditation practice, through mindful awareness of the body and breath. This is our great secret power as Buddhists, and all of you have experienced. this is an unpacking of what my teacher said, every breath, new chances. That's a teaching from vertical time. Vertical time, in the simplest practice terms, is your exhale. You know, each exhale goes into the space of the vertical. In fact, it is vertical. You energetically feel it, like, you know, dropping down into your, into the earth, really. It's a grounding quality. There may be lots of mental activity going this way while you sit, and that's normal. You know, chatter here, chatter there, everywhere a chatter, chatter, you know. But then there's this, you know. And then the inhale comes out of the ground and fills you anew. And then this entire process happens in the kind of energetic vertical of the eternal present. And in that eternal present, there is no room for regret. There is no room for future worry. Those things could come flooding back. But that process of learning to recognize and abide in vertical time is the fundamental liberative message of the Buddha. What's past is gone. The future actually is unknown. The present is already in motion. What are you going to do? This is a famous Zen story, which in the interest of time I'll make very short, but this is an example of a woman teacher in Zen who shuts down an arrogant young man. He comes to the tea house on the way to the monastery with the whole Diamond Sutra and all of its commentaries on his back, carries it around. He's an expert. And she's making tea, and she says, oh, his name is Dushan. I've heard of you. You're quite well known. You're quite an expert on the Diamond Sutra, are you not? And he says, yeah, yes, I am. And he reaches for the tea, and she is not quite ready to serve it. And she says, you know, I've always wondered about a passage from the Diamond Sutra. It's always confused me. It says in the Diamond Sutra, past mind is not Godhead. Present mind is not Godhead. Future mind is not Godhead. So tell me, venerable sir, with which mind do you plan to drink this tea? And he chokes in every sense of the word. And he's astute enough to realize that he doesn't really understand the Diamond Sutra at all. He's not really grasped. She's talking about vertical time, you know. You can't think about it. The tea's in front of you. You have to drink it without, you know, right now, just reach out. And that would have been a pretty good answer if he just reached out and drank the tea. Thank you very much for the tea. But he was caught in his notions of himself, in his history as an eminent monk, and, you know, all that. So the story goes that he took off his pack, burned everything in it, and this is interesting because this is a Buddhism written by men. Then he goes up to the high monastery on the mountain where the great male teacher teaches and studies there. Anyway, that's a whole other topic I won't get into, but it's always important to know who wrote the histories, you know, who were these people. But, you know, this is, she's talking about vertical time. And vertical time is such a powerful, liberative process to cut through the horizontal story that we have about growing old. It's true. It's a true story, but it's not the whole truth. I have a little bit of time left, so I think I'm going to stop and allow people to interact a little bit. Should I be fairly strict about the 10:45?
Well, it's nice to give people an opportunity to leave at 10:45, but if you want to continue after that, for those who wish to stay.
Okay. Well, let's put it this way. It's 10:20. We have 5 minutes formally, and then we'll end maybe at 10:47. And then we'll stop, and then I'll hang around, of course. Anybody who wants to talk can talk. So if there anybody that wants to say something, yes.
You talking about, is it working? I wanted to talk about Alzheimer's and vertical time. My mom has, you know, advanced stages of Alzheimer's, and for a long time, it was very distressing to me, and I went through all the stages of, you know, denial and anger, and lately, it's been very liberating, actually, to be with her in the moment, and she actually feels like a teacher to me, mm-hmm. because she's totally unburdened by the past, mm-hmm. has no clue about the future, and it's really about just being right there. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite amazing. I mean, it's been very joyful and humorous sometimes, and it's always surprising. So just, it's the side of Alzheimer's that I hadn't heard it about before, but I really feel it every time I talk to her.
A lot of people going through what you're going through, a lot of Buddhist practitioners, and it's very, very painful. And a lot of people ask, you know, what does this mean in Buddhist terms? Part of what it means, and I'll just be very brief, is that there's a difference, which is very well laid out in Buddhist teaching, between the particularities of a human being and the essential humanness of a human being. And with Alzheimer's, the particularities go, but the essential human being remains. And that's a good teaching for us, because that's true for us now, for each of us, it's true. We have our particularities, but we also have, everybody breathes the same, including your mom. Someone else? back there and then up here. Oh, up here and then back there.
I don't know if this is perhaps my own sense of denial, but every time I hear about, you know, that things change, it seems like it could be presented in another way that things are different. So the change seems to always connect to loss, but does it always have to be that way? So, for example, now I'm in perimenopause, and one of the symptoms of that is kind of losing your short-term memory. So if things are different now, I don't remember anything. And not to say that that's not a problem, but it's just that's the way it is right now.
Yeah, well, that's good. I think that the teaching that everything changes is a little bit too terse, and it sounds kind of abstract. You know, if it's not bothering you, then it's not a problem. If it does bother you, then it is. So it just depends on what kind of change it is and how you respond to it. So good for you, you know, if it's not bothering you. But there may be some other kind of change for someone else or some other person who's in the same situation. It would bother them a lot. So it's really what, you know, it's really the experience you have, you know, of it. Yeah, the gentleman in the back?
Oh, no, I'm trying to speak up.
Oh, the microphone is on its way.
Thank you. I'm more interested in personal experience, yourself or the other American Buddhist leaders we have at IMC and Zen Center and all the spread of Buddhism through North America. The immediate experience of teachers, what states have you reached or other people reached? How are we doing? Do we have any enlightened folks among us? Do we have people who are equanimous, who are peaceful, who are joyful all the time? What progress has been made? You know, is it worth the effort?
Fair enough. I like that question. We need more of you guys. all of the above. I think that all of the above. I think that there's been, candidly, a pretty high casualty rate among the first generation of people who have practiced and tried to teach, casualty in all respects. But I think there have also been a beauty and some proof of the efficacy of the practice. But we have to be careful because realizing the truths of the Dharma doesn't instantly make you a perfect human being. It never does. And we still have our difficult karmic circumstances, our personality. And, you know, just to talk about the topic du jour, a lot of Buddhist teachers I know, and when I get together with them, we talk about getting old a lot. You know, how much longer are we going to be able to do this? There's a lot of, what illness do you have? What illness do I have? I personally, since you asked, have had a lot of illness in my history. And maybe it's what's turning me to this particular flavor of teaching right now is that I used to say that for a few years I was 90 years old, got younger, fortunately, because I got better. And I didn't do, from a surface point of view, I didn't do too well during some of those illnesses. I was frightened. I was terrified. I felt abandoned by the practice. I didn't know how the practice could help me. That's all part of the path. You know, to lose confidence, to lose faith, and then to regain it at a deeper level. So I think that sometimes I wonder, is it worth all the work we put into this? That's part of what you're asking, I think. I don't really know. I wish I could say, yep, 100%, signed, sealed, and delivered, or nope, waste of time. Take it from me. I think it's just a lot more complicated than that. I trust the truth of the basic teachings very, very deeply. I don't know yet if we've quite figured out in America, in the West, how to bring them to life in our world. That's, I think, what I think. It may take a lot longer than one lifetime or one generation to bring that about. I sometimes tell people, it's a 1,000-year project. Relax. I'm probably telling myself that because, you know, I have. Let's get it done, you know. Thank you for your question. Thank you for your attention. Let's close for today. And I'll put the flyers out in front here. You're welcome to take one. Or just check the website, IMC website or whatever. October 24th. Hope to see some of you then. Thank you very much.